Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
Thank you, Eddie C. Happy Earth Day, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Cherry Gregg. Avi, I got a question for you.
Okay.
You ever get hit
Didn't know there was a pop quiz at the top of this show. Okay.
You ever get hit with headline after headline after headline, and somewhere along the way you lose the plot of what's actually happening when the news cycle never stops?
Yes, but I'll never admit to it.
Well, today's show is a little bit of our answer to that, specifically when it comes to how our federal government funds scientific and medical research. You had all these headlines a year ago about budgets being slashed, but what actually happened? How have priorities shifted? Have we lost a step compared to global rivals, and what's next? You know, we're exploring today on the show fact from fiction when it comes to medical and scientific research in America, and we have two extremely knowledgeable guests in to help us unpack it. And our question for you today, are you worried that the U.S. is falling behind in health and science research? Has your own work or treatment been impacted by funding cuts? We want to hear from you on the phone line, 888-477-9499, or email us, studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment on the chat.
And I know for a fact that we have researchers who listen to this show. Because I remember one time we were having a conversation about whether it was good or bad when we talked about the weather. And a guy wrote in and said, it's good because I work in a lab. I work in a science lab and there are no windows. So that guy absolutely needs to call in. Everyone else who works in this field, we'd love to hear from you as well. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. But first, a trio of local news stories. And let's start right here in Philadelphia. There was a city council hearing yesterday on Philadelphia Mayor Sherelle Parker's rideshare tax proposal. It drew a lot of commentary and attention, and this really seems to be shaping up as the biggest public policy battle of the budget season here in Philadelphia. So to review, Parker wants to impose a $1 tax on every rideshare ride in city limits of Philadelphia. This would raise an estimated $50 million a year to help the school district close an impending budget deficit. Not surprising, companies like Lyft and Uber say this is a regressive tax that will hurt riders and drivers. And Uber seems to be fighting this tax especially aggressively. When riders in Philly open the app, they're hit with these messages saying, stop the $1 rideshare tax. Mayor Parker's tax would make your rides less affordable. And one of our listeners, Jonathan, actually sent us some of the messaging that Uber drivers have been receiving from the company, urging them to sign petitions, show up at town halls, testify in council. Perhaps to be expected, but Uber is clearly not going down without a fight here, Kevin. Pretty aggressive PR playbook from Uber on this one.
Yeah, and this has kind of been a central story, I would say, to how the city has funded schools over the past decade or more.
Absolutely.
Crisis emerges, services on the chopping block. The city finds some sort of product or service that might be considered niche. Cigarettes, liquor by the drink, sugary beverages. Each time you have a lobbying group step up, push back against it. In those three cases we just mentioned, ultimately they failed. But there's also some pushback from city council right now on this issue as well. They don't like maybe how aggressively the mayor has been kind of going it alone on this.
Yeah, and at the same time, the school district has a proposal. They're going to vote on it tomorrow, actually, that involves, among other things, closing schools. And that hits city council members especially hard, because if you're going to close a school in my district and then ask me to, you know, tax my residents further to send money to the school district, as a city council member, maybe I don't like the optics of that. And by the way, Sean Walsh in The Inquirer wrote a piece on this very topic. I think it came out yesterday or maybe it was this morning. Worth your time reading. So there are some unusual optics around this particular tax that might make it less palatable to city council members.
And I would just say one more quick thing on this, the macro optics, right? There's plenty of education advocates who feel like the state government hasn't done its part to fund city schools, despite, you know, the lawsuit and the win and all that.
Yeah.
And now here's another tax that's falling on Philadelphians to pay for what some could argue should be more of a shared
expense. But one more zigzag here, which is that the city council could do another thing here, because you talked about they do all these one-time sort of niche taxes. They could raise property taxes. Right. That's always an option, and they have often declined to do that. And you get way more money from property taxes than you get from taxing Uber or cigarettes or whatever. Anyways, Story number two.
Story number two. The president and CEO of Pico is being reassigned after calling for a major rate hike on customers. So David Vahaus has put forward a plan that would have raised bills for electricity customers in Philadelphia and the suburbs by 12.5%, with an additional hike for natural gas customers. The company said this was a necessary way to upgrade energy infrastructure, but the proposal came after a year of record profits for Pico, and Governor Josh Shapiro had weighed in and slammed the idea as, quote, pure greed. And in fact, a rate hike that went into effect in 2025 boosted Pico's net profits from $551 million to $814 million. Following that pressure from Shapiro, Pico rescinded its latest proposed rate hike and has now reshuffled its leadership, tapping Mike Innocenzo, who had previously been the president and CEO, to take on the new role as interim on an interim basis. And Pico told our reporter, Susan Phillips, that the proposed rate hikes and the personnel changes were, quote, separate matters.
So just to recap, they put forward a rate hike proposal. Mm-hmm. It was controversial. Mm-hmm. The very popular governor of the state slammed it. Mm-hmm. And then the CEO was dismissed, removed, whatever term you want to use, and they brought in someone on an interim basis, mm-hmm. and those things are all unrelated. Just to recap, that mm-hmm. is Pico's
right.
take on all this, right. which maybe we'll find out that's true. Obviously, looking from the outside, it seems very hard to believe, but this is their line here is that they're bringing in an interim person. Interim usually means you weren't planning to do it,
right.
But it has nothing to do with this very right. public fight with the governor and others. So I don't know. Maybe that's how it'll shake out. We'll see, I suppose.
And the other thing, you know, here is this question of energy infrastructure upgrades. Like, we've been talking many times on the show about how our grid is not up to snuff for the 21st century, yep. and there need to be investments in it. They're claiming they needed this rate hike to be able to make those upgrades.
And some of those, by the way, those infrastructure changes are related to Pico and others say to climate change.
Right.
Right. Because you're going to need more power demand and that also data centers. There's a bunch of stuff going on. But there's legitimate reasons to think that there's going to be greater demands and different types of demands on our energy infrastructure.
Right. And I guess the question for some ratepayers is, well, why can't Pico take less profit to be able to make those investments? And right. why do they need
absorb
to
the cost?
Exactly.
Yeah. Story number three. There is a social club opening in Fishtown that's also kind of like a fancy parking garage, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around exactly what it is. The club is called Cannonball. The Philadelphia Business Journal says it will open this summer on Frankfort Avenue. The target demographic here is car enthusiasts.
Okay.
You come to this club, you meet other gearheads, you talk shop. You can also browse the collector cars that other members will store at this Cannonball Club. They're calling it a cathedral of cars. That sounds nice. Cannonball will also include, in addition to this fancy parking garage, a restaurant, a bar, a co-working space for okay. some reason, and a coffee shop. And the owners of Cannonball say they want this to be the first location in a national chain. They envision opening car cathedrals in South Jersey, Scottsdale, Orange County, and elsewhere. So, Car Social Club, Kevin McCrory, do you understand what this is? Do you think you get it? Are you confused? You look confused.
I'm a car enthusiast.
You are?
In that I like to go from point A to point B. I got a lot of things to do.
You're enthusiastic about being in a car.
I like going from point A to point B. I can't wait for this, actually. How about this? Rolling in on a Friday night with my Chrysler minivan, right?
I don't know if anyone can roll their car into this place. I'm not quite sure on the specifics here.
Yeah, I could pop in there. I got my hood open. I got my crunched up leaves under the hood. I got my jackets, my kids' jackets, and old homework assignments are all over the floor. And then the big reveal is I take out the car seats and we play a little game of guess what food we find under the car seats.
I would rather do that, honestly, than look at a Lamborghini. That sounds like a fun game to me. What kind of food is often under there, by the
way? Cracker bits, old French fries, maybe a peanut butter sandwich or two. Yeah.
Peanut butter sandwich. Well, at least no milk. One time when we were growing up, we accidentally left a carton of milk underneath one of the seats. And we could not figure out what the smell was for a long, long time, but it was really lodged in a peculiar way. And the whole car, this was a Chevy Nova. So we're dating ourselves here. This was a light blue Chevy Nova. The whole car smelled like sour skunk for about a month. It was really horrific. It's like a searing childhood memory. Anyways, I'm not a car guy is really what I'm saying here. And I cannot imagine paying money to look at other people's cars, but if this is your thing, go forth. I wish you well. And I wish well to the people of Cannonball with this idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I'm in a bubble, I guess. I guess I don't know that there's people out there who really just love to show up. I mean, I guess I knew. I didn't think there'd be enough of them in Philadelphia.
What's the name of that show? There's a very famous show where it's all about fancy cars.
Like the Jay Leno stuff or whatever?
Yeah, no, it's like a British show. It's a huge show. It's like one of the biggest shows in the world. It's called Top Drives. Someone will write in and tell us about it. People love cars. People love cars. I don't love cars. I'm A to B like you. But I definitely acknowledge there's a huge community of people out there that just love to look at, talk about fancy cars.
Okay.
Americans are car people. Sure. We're not, which makes us un-American. Today we're going to talk about something that actually is a very American idea, the idea that the government provides quite a bit of money to seed the research and medical community. But will they going forward? There's a lot of debate about that. We're going to talk about what's happened so far with research cuts under the Trump administration 2.0 and what could happen in the future. Give us a call if you have thoughts on this. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Cherry Gregg. When President Donald Trump came into office last year, he proposed massive funding cuts to the National Institutes of Health and other agencies. Advocates feared that billions of dollars lost would dramatically reshape the future of American innovation and research.
Now, Congress ultimately stood behind the NIH and held the line against those cuts, but reductions, reorganizations, and red tape have left many researchers in the lurch and raised questions about the future of American research. And now Trump's latest budget again calls for big reductions at the NIH, NASA, the National Science Foundation, the EPA, and other government agencies that fund health and science initiatives.
Now, we're going to dive today into exactly what's happening in the field of research today and its ongoing impact. What's the latest on canceled grants, scaled back clinical trials, and a priority shift away from critical discoveries like mRNA vaccines?
We've got two great experts with us this hour to unpack it all. Dr. Alyssa Sinclair is the Joan Bassert Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and an incoming Assistant Professor of Psychological Sciences at Rice University, Ali Sinclair. Welcome to Studio 2. Great to see you.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. And also with us is Max Kozlov, a science journalist at Nature. Max, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And we want to hear from our audience today. Are you worried that the U.S. is falling behind in health and science research? Has your own work or treatment been impacted by funding cuts? You can call us 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
Max, help me understand something. We heard last year that the Trump administration wanted to make huge budget reductions at agencies like NIH, right? Then Congress rejected that proposal and held the funding mostly constant, I think raised it a little bit. And yet we're still seeing headlines now about people losing grant money or fewer grants being funded. So how can all of these things coexist, Max?
That's a great question. And it's one that we get a lot. And it's one that we've been covering at Nature extensively this past year. Essentially, on paper, yes, the budget amount actually increased last year. Congress rejected the 40% cut that the Trump administration was seeking, but it's through a series of, I would say, bureaucratic and somewhat wonky and boring moves that have really hampered the scientific enterprise in the United States. And what I mean by that is fewer awards have gone out, which means fewer labs have gotten funded. There is a long list of disfavored topics on which research has been canceled or paused or disrupted in some way. And these labs are kind of like small businesses where if funding all of a sudden gets cut off, they leave all of the staff kind of in the lurch. And they have to make tough decisions about laying people off. So in some cases, that funding might have been restored, but that disruption still persists. And we're talking about research on things like cancer, Alzheimer's, on things like vaccine hesitancy and vaccine development. All of these have been disrupted, even if on paper, yes, they got a slight funding. Well, the NIH has a lot of the National Institutes of Health that gives out billions of dollars of funding, has a lot of these tools that can slow down funding. And that's what we've been seeing this past year.
So top line number stays the same, but you have to look under the hood to really understand what's going on. And it seems partly what's going on is there's kind of a philosophical shift in thinking in how they allocate funding. And they're saying we're going to fund fewer projects and give them more money up front, as opposed to funding more projects and giving them money year over year. Do I have that correctly?
You have that right. And it's not necessarily a bad idea. What it means is that as the NIH goes from year to year, they have fewer commitments from past years that they need to fulfill. And so they kind of start with a clean slate. The problem is when the budget stays the same, and, you know, of course there's inflation, so it, even if the budget is staying the same, it's still a little reduced. That means fewer people get funded, because it's kind of a zero sum game here, where if you're giving labs more money from that year's pot of money instead of a little bit from each year's, that means fewer people can get funded. And that's exactly what we saw this past year, with 3,000 to 4,000 fewer grants going out. And a lot of that has hurt early career researchers. And they're kind of looking at the writing on the wall, and they're seeing, maybe there isn't a place for me here. And that has been a story that we've been covering extensively at Nature.
I guess the Trump administration's argument might be we're front-loading more money towards the highest, best research opportunities. And the maybe scientists who aren't being funded are saying, well, there's just a lot less opportunity for the rest of us. And there's some sort of philosophical trade-off there. Is it fair to couch it like that?
Yeah. Again, I think on paper, or the idea of doing this, some other agencies fund grants like this. I think, though, what people would tell you, even who are in favor of this, is you probably want to do it at a time that the budget is increasing, not staying the same, because that would not result in thousands of fewer people getting funded. And what it's done is it's turned a competitive process. It's really, really competitive to get some of these grants, and it's kind of dialed that up even further.
It's super competitive.
It's extremely, extremely competitive. Exactly.
Our question of the day, by the way, for you out there listening: are you worried the U.S. is falling behind in health and science research? Has your own work or treatment been impacted by funding cuts? We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. So, Ali Sinclair, if indeed there are fewer people receiving this money, who are these people? What type of work were they doing? David, one of our listeners, says cancer research is especially vulnerable because it draws heavily on NIH support across basic science, clinical trials, and translational work. Alzheimer's and other neurological disorders also face risk because they require long-term expensive studies that are easy to slow but hard to restart. That's David's perspective. I'm curious, Ali, if you can help us understand who's not getting money anymore.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it sort of extends to the points that Max was making. So first, this idea that he brought up with multi-year funding, we're losing the power of that investment in science as well. So in addition to fewer projects being funded, that means that we're taking this federal budget, we're giving larger chunks of it to fewer projects, and those projects are going to continue spending at the same rate that they would have otherwise, meaning that many of those dollars are being essentially parked in a parking lot, right? There's some savings account that is going to fund that project for multiple years, but de facto, the actual number of projects spending at a typical rate has gone down. And so less science is being done, and that has consequences.
In terms of real quick, why wouldn't they spend it now? Like, if they're getting more money, I'm giving you $1 million instead of $500,000? Why am I parking it and saving it for future years? Why am I not hiring another lab tech right now?
Well, typically there are other constraints. So, for example, the space of your facilities, right? You can only have so many personnel in your lab. There's also just management and mentorship constraints. So the director of a lab might not be able to hire double the number of staff that they normally would. And also projects take time, right? We have to, you know, for example, in a clinical trial, you'd need to be seeking ethical approval. You'd need to be recruiting participants. You might be following them over time through a hospital system. These are things that you can't just accelerate and throw more money at the problem. So with this multi-year fund scheme, we're seeing that larger sums of money are being given out immediately, but that's still intended to be used over, say, a 4 or 5 year period, meaning that people are not really going to be able to accelerate their spending more than they typically would. They should still rationally be, you know, spreading out their expenses over that 4 year period. But fewer projects have actually been funded. And so we're seeing that the rate of actual science being done has gone down because of this.
Allie, I guess part of what is going on here too is if there's fewer projects being greenlit, the Trump administration is kind of zeroing in maybe on the projects that it sees as political in nature and kind of, you know, not letting those go through and favoring other ones that it finds more maybe neutral. Is that part of it? And what are those projects that, you know, on the whole aren't going through?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that could be. We're seeing that there are new layers of political appointee review that are being inserted into the grant approval process. And we're seeing dramatically fewer funding opportunities being posted, meaning that there's a real bottleneck. There are some additional layers of review and bureaucracy that are new that are sort of filtering what kinds of scientific funding opportunities are available and what's actually going out. One way that we can take a look at the areas of research that are harder hit is to look at the White House's new fiscal year 2027 budget proposal. Mm-hmm. If we look here, we can look at the directorates within the National Science Foundation and the institutes which within the NIH, and we can see where we're seeing relatively greater budget cuts. So first, looking at the NIH, we're seeing the biggest cuts to the budget for research on allergy and infectious diseases, which is related also to the work, you know, for example, related to COVID, related to transmission of disease and related to vaccines. We're also seeing substantial cuts to research on substance use and addiction, and they're trying to entirely eliminate a minority health division as well. Mm. Looking at the National Science Foundation, they're trying to entirely eliminate a directorate on social, behavioral, and economic sciences. This is particularly personal because that's my area. I'm a cognitive neuroscientist and a psychologist by training. And we're also seeing relatively larger cuts to biology, engineering, and global collaboration directorates at the NSF.
Let me bring in a caller now. This is Brad from Pottstown who is on the line. By the way, our question, are you worried about the U.S. falling behind in health and science research? Has your own work or treatment been impacted by funding cuts? Let us know. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Again, Brad from Pottstown on the line. Brad, curious for your perspective. You're on Studio 2.
Hi, my name, my son graduated from Cornell Weill 2 years ago with a degree in PhD immunological research and oncology. He hasn't been able to find a job because of the budget cuts. He spent 7 years there getting his PhD, had a very forward-looking, promising career, and it's all the rug has been yanked completely out from under him every place he turns. Drug companies, NIH, every institution you have mentioned, nobody is hiring. Mm. And he says if they think it's going to stop the research, it's not. It's going overseas.
Yeah.
And he's actually had offers from companies outside the United States. He doesn't want to leave the United States. But most big researchers are seriously considering leaving the country. Huh. We are falling behind.
Brad, real quick, I mean, how close is he to maybe leaving the country? Is he at this point, after a couple of years, pretty tempted to go, or is he really committed to trying to stick it out here?
He said he's trying to stick it out here. He's right now teaching in New York, one of the New York colleges, as a biology instructor. But he is trying. He was hoping things would start settling out. But he told me just recently that his alma mater is looking at serious funding cuts for a number of their research departments. Mm.
I think Brad's comment there
speaks
to, thank you, Brad, you know, the impact on younger scientists specifically. And I guess I'm just thinking from like a person who's applied for grants for media journalism, et cetera. If you have a relationship with the grantor and you have a track record of success, you're more likely to get the grant. And if there's fewer opportunities and you're a new person in the game, the odds are going to be stacked against you. And there's some, I guess, real fear on how this impacts younger scientists and medical researchers coming in. Max, could you speak more to that?
Yeah. And Brad, I'm so sorry to hear about your son's struggles. And I know it's not just him. You know, we've heard so many stories like your son's in our reporting. And we did a poll early on in the first year of the Trump administration last year, asking scientists, are you thinking about leaving the country? And we had a whopping, I think it was like 75% that said that they were considering it. Now, I don't think that's going to come to pass. It's not like we're going to have 3/4 of our scientists in this country move out of the country. However, if even a fraction of that comes to pass, I mean, we're seeing a generational setback here, because people always ask me, you know, will things go back to normal if maybe the NIH goes back the way that to the way that it ran things before the Trump administration? And I mean, yes, but this moving of talent abroad or moving of talent into the private industry, that's not something that can be corrected overnight. And so I think that's the real worry when I'm talking to people who have been in the field for a long time. They worry most about what this means for the future generations of scientists. And I think other countries are seeing this as an opportunity, to be quite honest. We've covered how a number of countries have these kinds of recruitment schemes to attract scientists, because they know that there are a lot of talented scientists that are on the market. And so I think we're going to continue to see folks potentially going abroad and
can you give me an example of
extend beyond.
Can you give me an example, Max, of a country that is being extra aggressive in this space that seems to be looking to expand its research pie?
Yeah, the European Union has had a big recruitment scheme. So we covered one from France, and we covered, I think there were about 40 scientists that were moving from the United States to France. Obviously, that is a tiny number. But if that signals the start of a trend, that is worrying, because it's not just the European Union. There are other countries across the globe that are trying to attract this talent. And, you know, we've covered also how China has been a growing power in the scientific world, you know, from the top universities, the top cited universities, and the number of papers that are being published. So a lot of folks have said this is almost hamstringing us at a very critical moment when another global superpower, China, has been really investing in science.
Yeah, could we speak a little bit about Jay Bhattacharya, who's the director of the NIH, who he is, how he kind of came into power, and his role in the Trump administration? Because it feels like he has some difference compared to, say, the budget manager, but he might be more aligned on some of the priority goals. Max, you could take that one.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so Jay Bhattacharya, he had been a professor at Stanford in kind of health economics for some time, and he really, his big claim to fame was the what's called the Great Barrington Declaration. So he and a couple of other doctors had this moment in the COVID-19 pandemic where they wanted to kind of, I guess, let it rip almost, let the virus rip, and kind of keep the vulnerable at home, and, you know, we shouldn't have lockdowns, we shouldn't have masking or vaccine mandates. And this was criticized by a lot of leading scientists at the time because, one, it's not so easy to just, quote unquote, keep the vulnerable at home. And it would lead to a higher number of deaths and severe outcomes in general. So I think they were kind of taking this, well, there should be more personal freedom approach. There should be, you know, we shouldn't have mandates. And so his rise to power is really, I think, a backlash to people who felt that scientific dissent was suppressed, or rather scientific discussion was suppressed during the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, kind of maybe anger after the way that the Biden administration handled the COVID-19 pandemic.
And then you fast forward to now, and he's in power, and he's not the one who's advocating for less funding for NIH. In fact, he's saying he wants to have the money and spend it. And, you know, we can get into the ins and outs of that. But there is this interesting thing where it seems like he and Republicans in Congress recognize the value in the NIH, and you have, you know, Trump's budget secretary again calling for a cut, and there's some dissonance among Republicans in D.C. Could you speak more to that?
Yeah, and I mean, he says many things that he wants to support science, that he's supporting early career researchers. I guess the question I would have there is, you know, do the data show that? And we've seen again that the number of research grants that have gone out has gone down and the pace has gone down. So I would question that commitment. He also has said many times, well, there aren't any funding cuts. And what he's saying there is that there were questions if the NIH would actually spend all of its money by the end of the year. And to his credit, it did. So that's what he means when he says there haven't been funding cuts. But in what Ali and I have been saying is, well, there has been a ton of research on disfavored topics that has been cut, that has been terminated, that has been disrupted. And I just wanted to mention the fact that that's unprecedented. The NIH doesn't terminate grants normally. That right. is something absolutely new that happened last year. I think I spoke to a top official at the NIH who said he could count on one hand the number of grants that were terminated in the previous 10 years before the Trump administration. Yeah. And just this past year, there were on the order of thousands of canceled grants. So, yes, administrations have different priorities. Yes, you know, maybe AI and quantum is important for the Trump administration, but that doesn't typically mean that you go and cancel all of the research about vaccine hesitancy, right. about
a significant change in approach, for sure.
Let
me bring in another caller. This is Mike from Upper Darby on line 2, and I'll remind you, we're asking you today, are you worried the U.S. is falling behind in health and science research? Has your own work or treatment been impacted by funding cuts? Our number is 888-477-9499, and our email is studio2@whyy.org. Mike from Upper Darby, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
The comment is a previous caller was talking about his son or daughter considering having to move abroad to have a career and pursue science. And the move of talent in that direction seems like the very opposite of what happened in the U.S. in the end of World War II and beyond, when Wernher von Braun and other brilliant nuclear scientists came to the U.S. and the U.S. became a world leader in physics, in space, and hasn't really yielded that as a result of that base. And it feels like if our scientists are going abroad, it's the wrong direction.
Right. So traditionally, what Mike is saying is that America was a safe harbor for scientists coming from countries that were undergoing some sort of cataclysmic change or where they were perhaps being persecuted. Mike's worried now the opposite will happen. On the other side of the break, actually, let's talk about how immigration policy interfaces with all of this, because we haven't gotten to that topic yet. And it is one of the issues that I think some labs and some researchers are dealing with. We'll try to get to the bottom of just how prevalent that is. We've been talking with Max Kozlov, science journalist at Nature, and Ali Sinclair, who is at the University of Pennsylvania and soon to be at Rice University, all about the changes in federal funding for science and health research. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Cherry Gregg. We've been talking about some new potential cuts to the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, NASA, and other agencies in the Trump administration's recent budget proposal. Labs and researchers across the country have already tightened their budgets, and many young scientists say they're concerned about the future in their field.
Our guests are Ali Sinclair, a Penn Research Fellow and incoming Assistant Professor of Psychological Sciences at Rice University, as well as Max Kozlov, a science journalist at Nature.
And as always, we want to hear from you listening and watching on YouTube. Are you worried that the U.S. is falling behind in health and science research? Has your own work or treatment been impacted by funding cuts? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org or drop a comment in the chat on social media.
Susan emails us and says the problem is an en masse lack of understanding of the scientific method. Susan, going wide there. I wanted to ask you, Ali Sinclair, about immigration policy and how that's impacting research labs. Are we seeing a big impact there? If so, what are some of the problems people are running into right now? Give us a sort of an overview, if you could.
That's a great question. I think we're seeing the biggest impacts here for the early career researchers who are seeking faculty positions in particular. So here we're seeing that due to changes in visa situations and potential, like there's a $100,000 fee, I believe, that might apply to new people trying to enter the country for skilled work. We're seeing that many universities in response are currently not considering international applicants who are not already in the US for faculty positions. This is creating a real problem for non-US citizens who are seeking opportunities to start their own labs and do research in the US. So we're seeing a big impact on that part of the pipeline there. For graduate students, we are still seeing international students being admitted, but there are generally speaking disruptions to that training pipeline overall. We're seeing far fewer opportunities for graduate students in general. As a little bit of context, PhD students are paid a stipend to support their living expenses because they're really essential workers in the research infrastructure. There's an expense there that is a financial commitment on the part of universities to support students for 5 or so years of their program. And so with the funding cuts and the budget tightening that we're seeing, there are far fewer opportunities for young scientists to be trained. And that will be particularly impacting international students as well.
I don't know if you have like a top line number handy or just a general sense, but like about how many people who run labs, who work in labs, who are graduate students in labs are people who have visas traditionally? Like how many people are non-native born Americans?
I'm afraid I don't have a top line number ready for you on that, but I will say that a substantial number of graduate students, I would say at least a third typically are international students. So this really is a large part of the scientific workforce. And as I think the conversation previously alluded to, I think that's been a crucial part of making America a leader in scientific research, medical research, and innovation, right? We're really able to attract top talent from around the world to advance science. And right now we're at risk of losing that advantage.
Yeah, we've been talking about a lot of what happened already, and now we have these new budget cuts on the table. Max, if we can turn back to politics for a moment, we do see this bipartisan slapback against what the Trump administration is pushing, yet here they come with another proposal. Do you have a sense of like what they're after? Because they know that they're going to get pushback even from Republicans on Capitol Hill. And as we've been talking about, they're able to get their priorities through these other means, even if the overall number doesn't come down. So why are they pushing again for it to come down? Do you have insight on that?
Yeah, I mean, this happens every year where the administration comes to Congress with their proposal. And oftentimes Congress, you know, reviews it, they look at it, but they will do their own thing. Now, you know, what you saw last year was a dramatic cut proposed for the NIH, 40% cut, and that would take the National Institutes of Health back to, I believe, like 2002 levels. And there has historically been bipartisan support for NIH because it's just something that both sides of the aisle can get behind. We're talking about cures for cancer. We're talking about cures for Alzheimer's. Now, this year, it is a much leaner cut that they're proposing, only 10% But Congress already does not seem inclined to go along with that. We saw testimony yesterday because RFK is on the Hill this week defending the proposed cuts. And already you've heard Republicans including saying we want to support health research. This is something that's really important to us. Now, I still think it's important to pay attention to the budget request, and Ali alluded to this earlier, because it signifies what exactly they want to change. It signifies where the Trump administration's head is at for what programs they want to cut. And so again, when you're looking at the National Institutes of Health, for example, you see there that they want to cut an entire institute devoted to studying health disparities, why one population is less healthy than another population. And they also want to continue this practice of forward funding that we talked about earlier, except instead of only 30 to 40% of the grants being funded in this way, they want to make all of them funded that way.
Right.
So that would kind of amplify the effects of fewer researchers getting funded times more than twice.
Yeah, it's still a roadmap for their thinking, even if they don't end up getting the cuts that they ask for. Let me bring in another caller. And by the way, our number 888-477-9499, our email studio2@whyy.org. This is Christine from Newtown on the line. Christine, you're on Studio 2. I'd love to hear your perspective.
Hi, I'm going to speak quickly to not take up time. I run a nonprofit called A Love for Life that is really dedicated to raising money for pancreatic cancer research at the Abramson Cancer Center here in Philadelphia. And we've been doing that for about 10 years. And back in April of last year, just huge cuts with DOGE across the board for medical research funding, for the arts, for educational programs. And that weekend, every event that I attended, everyone was saying how important it was that philanthropists and people with money and neighbors and friends step up to fund all of these things privately because of the funding cuts. And it's crazy to me that, you know, our tax dollars are not being used for the things that we as a community and as people care about being funded. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have a war going on. We've got a lot of money going all kinds of places, and yet the research team and the researchers at Penn, like, we threw our first ever gala, because we give 100%, which means I would pay for the gala. We had our first gala last October, and we raised a ton of money, but it's not sustainable.
Right.
I don't think that we, as individual organizations, little grassroots places, can fund.
Yeah, you can't backfill
it
all.
That the government has, you know, stepped back.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much,
and
Christine.
Thank you for this discussion.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Of course. Yeah, I'm curious, building off of Christine's comment, Ali Sinclair, like, if you are a lab that's lost some money or is experiencing some disruption with bringing in, you know, workers because of immigration issues, like, how long can you hold on? You know, can you hold on for a year? Can you backfill for a year, 6 months, 2 years? Like, because we don't know how labs work. They seem like they don't work exactly like typical businesses, but they have some components of that. How long can a researcher hold on if there is disruption in their funding flow or their employment pipeline?
Mm-hmm. First, I'll just briefly say thank you, Christine, for sharing your story. I think your example really highlights that funding from NIH and NSF is not just going to universities. It's going to nonprofit organizations. It's going to health tech companies. It's going to research hospitals and places like that, too. And all of these places feel the fallout. And private funding and philanthropic funding really just cannot make up the difference. It's such a tiny slice of the pie relative to what we get from federal funding. In response to your question about how long a lab can hold on, especially with what we've been seeing with terminated grants, often not long. Science funding is not a faucet that should be turned off and turned back on again. When you cut off the flow of funding, you can't cover people's salaries anymore. You can't cover the research expenses that are occurring day to day. And so we're seeing clinical trials being halted. You know, patients who might have been followed over time are now, you know, the trial is over. You can't keep following up with them and start starting it up again is much harder. We have lab staff, you know, postdocs in particular, who are being let go because they, you know, we can't cover their salaries anymore if the funding has run out. So this is a real problem, and we're seeing that in particular early career researchers are having this disruption where there are fewer opportunities to work as a research associate or to work as a postdoctoral researcher. And with those runways running out, there's nowhere to go. And that will contribute to that departure of talent from the U.S. or from the entire field of science, with people leaving for other non-scientific positions where, you know, people got to eat, right? We got to find a way to get a job if those opportunities are disappearing within science.
Yeah, Max, could you say more, I guess, about private funding? There might be some idea that, you know, why can't the private sector, why can't big pharma fund, you know, this sort of research on its own, and maybe help us understand how over the course of decades, United States federal investment in these sorts of things have benefited society. I know that's kind of a big question, but could you give us the macro view on that?
No, it's a great question. Essentially, the NIH is incredible at funding basic science. Now, of course, pharma companies have a lot of money and fund a lot of research in their own right, but that's often driven by some kind of profit incentive. And we know that you can't just jump into clinical trials. You need to do the legwork to get to that point. What that means is doing work on animal models or a discovery before you even get to that point. And that the NIH kind of excels at that. That's its bread and butter. And we're talking about, to Ali's point, we're talking about a $48 billion, that's with a B, billion-dollar agency. It gives out that amount of money every year. That's just, it can't be very easily replaced by private foundations or even other funders in the research ecosystem.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the research that has led to things like the Ozempic drug. That it was the NIH that funded the basic research that discovered that compound that then led to this translational, this medicine being available right. for
So categorically, they're sort of funding different types of research. That point is well taken. But we mentioned earlier, very briefly, Max, that there are fields, there are sections of science, there are types of research that may be getting more money now as other types of research get cut off. Can you give us a brief tour of the types of research? I think you mentioned AI, quantum computing, the types of research that actually might stand to win if indeed the Trump administration's priorities persist over several years.
Of course, yeah. So we've certainly seen AI and quantum across the government, but especially at places like the Department of Energy, the National Science Foundation. They're leaning really hard into those topics. At the NIH, Jay Bhattacharya, the NIH director, has talked a lot about going back to the roots and funding basic, I guess he would say maybe unpolitical science. And focusing on RFK's mission to combat chronic diseases.
Got it.
So that those are the topics that they say that they are favoring. I think the problem is it's really hard to like they define political science really nebulously. You know, they've talked a lot about rooting out DEI. Sure, that could be a goal of the Trump administration, but as it applies to science, I don't think anybody fully understands what that means and what that has resulted in. And I actually just saw a headline from the New York Times today about this, is that the staff at the NIH are being asked to review every single grant. Is this DEI? Is this DEI? And the way that they're doing that is they're looking at the keywords. They're looking at, does it use the word gender, inequity? And these are, like, many of these words are used in many different ways, in maybe in a way that doesn't actually mean that it's a DEI grant. But this is, like, what they're being asked to do, and it's taking up a lot of time. And with fewer people being available to work on this because so many people left or were laid off this past year. That's resulted in money going out at a much slower pace.
Yeah, and an email from Tim who wanted to highlight that the NIH is not spending all the money Congress has approved. He also says we haven't even touched on the tremendous morale loss at the NIH, which is also a victim of these changes. And Max, you were alluding to that as well. Closing thoughts for you, Ali Sinclair, in about 45 seconds. What are you looking for over the next few months that you think could have a really, really big impact in this space?
I think this is a crucial time for people to speak out and contact their representatives to emphasize the impact that the proposed budget would have on their communities and on science in the U.S. So these personal stories that we've been hearing from people calling in, share those with your representatives and share with them how constituents in their areas are going to be impacted. One thing that I want to highlight is that I'm co-founder of the Science and Community Impacts Mapping Project, or SIMAP. You can find our newly revamped website at scienceimpacts.org. And we've created interactive maps so you can explore the economic fallout of these policy changes to see how your local communities will be impacted by these funding cuts to science.
Thank you so much. Final word there from Ali Sinclair. Joan Bosser, postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and an incoming assistant professor of psychological sciences at Rice University. We also heard this hour from Max Kozlov, science journalist at Nature. We thank you both for your time today on Studio 2.
Today's show was produced by Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Paige Marie Bessler. Al Banks and Tina Calique are our engineers, and Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. I'm executive producer Kevin McCory.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. I thought you were going to read that part. And we'll talk to you tomorrow.